Whoever you are, wherever you are, whenever it is, you're catching some brainwaves. Coming to you from the banks of the peerless and hungry St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Ben Kolb, and across the table is the co-host who's never had to ask, what does a fox say? Becky Peters. Becky, what's good?
Everything is good, Ben. I'm so thrilled to be helping us all be more informed, inspired, and connected educators by bringing rock star interviews to the ears of busy teachers and hopefully making us smile too. And to that end, I have an awesome joke. Are you ready?
I'm definitely ready.
Okay, what do a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, a pilot, and an NBA athlete all have in common?
I have no idea.
They have all learned from Daniel Pink.
I don't know if that's exactly a joke.
I guess. I can work on the punchline of that. But seriously, it's so amazing to have on our show today a guest who literally the entire world could learn something from. I mean, there are very few books you could get as a gift for somebody that would be universally helpful in any discipline. And you could put a Daniel Pink book in front of anyone and it would improve their work and life by reading it. Daniel has authored 6 provocative books, including his newest, which is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. His other books include the long-running New York Times bestseller A Whole New Mind, and also Drive and To Sell as Human. If I could recommend one of those right now besides When, it would be Drive. It's an excellent book that we didn't really get to dive into during this specific interview, but if you're at all interested in the science of motivation, and as teachers, I think that's pretty applicable for all of us, I would highly encourage you to pick up that book to learn all about the surprising truth behind what motivates us. And spoiler alert, it boils down to autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Anyways, we're so lucky to have Daniel on the show today, and we couldn't be more excited to talk about When.
Absolutely. And he has just tons of research-based advice that we can put into practice right away into our classrooms. And it's awesome because he actually caters this advice to us busy teachers. So looking forward to that. But before we dive into that with Daniel today, we want to put into practice something that we learned last week from NeuroTeach author and brain guru Glenn Whitman. And he said one way to prime the brain for learning is to have your learner think about everything they know about a topic before you dive into that topic. And so we are going to put that into practice today and prime our brain. So on the show today, we have Daniel Pink, who's going to talk to us about the science of perfect timing. So we would like you to think about everything you know about timing. Does timing matter? What is the impact of timing? Does when you do something actually impact the results? What does the research say about the best time to do different things? So we're going to give you 15 seconds here of quiet thinking music. Feel free to push the pause button and extend that, but think about everything you know about timing.
Well, my brain is ready to rock. I know I learned so much from Daniel's book, When, and from this conversation. Before this, I never really thought about when I did things throughout the day, but his practical advice has changed when I respond to emails, when we record these podcasts, and when I schedule my most important work.
Me too. And in this interview, we talk about specific advice for how teachers should start and end the year, which is very applicable right now, what you should be doing on your off periods to come back even stronger for your next class, and we learn about our biological propensity to peak, trough, and recovery. Awesome. Well, let's get going here. So Miles Davis said, timing isn't the main thing, it's the only thing. Why was he right?
Time and timing plays a much bigger role in our lives than most of us realize. It operates mostly invisibly, but at a very deep meta level, you know, we human beings are temporal creatures. We've all heard about a biological clock. We essentially have biological clocks in every cell in our body. And we also live in a temporal environment. I mean, it's weird, but this conversation, Ben and Becky, we started it in the past and we'll finish it in the future. That's like freaky, right? And so so time and timing is omnipresent, and that's why it matters so much. And then when you look at some of the research on timing, which I did for this book, When, you realize that timing has an enormous role in our performance in any kind of job, including teachers. It has an effect on how students perform. And it's something that we need to take more seriously than we previously have.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What is the impact when we get the when of things wrong? You have a number of examples in your book, but specifically to education, if you could speak, that'd be really helpful.
Oh, yeah. There are gazillions of examples of that. I'll give you two. So one thing I write about And again, it's a particular study, but the particular study exemplifies a huge effect of time of day and how it shapes our behavior, whether we're 53 or whether we're 13. And there's a study of standardized tests in Denmark. And Denmark students take standardized tests as they do here in the States. But they take the tests on computers. And the typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time. Consequently, the students are randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. Some take in the morning, some take them in the afternoon. Now, that seems like a fairly benign thing. Like as a parent, as a citizen, I would look at that and say, okay, that's cool. But it's not cool because students who take the test in the afternoon score considerably lower. Students who take the test in the afternoon score as if they've missed 2 weeks of school. So that's a big deal. So time of day has a big effect. Just time of day alone has a big effect on our performance. And we can go deeper into the specifics of that. And then we look at another issue of timing in schools, which is much better known, but still is a stubbornly, most districts aren't doing anything about it, which is school start time for teenagers. What we know about there's a whole field called chronobiology. Chronobiology, chrono meaning time, biology, study of life. It's a study of our biological rhythms. And one of the things that we know from that field is each of us has a chronotype, that is our propensity. Do we wake up early and go to sleep early? Do we wake up late and go to sleep late? That changes over people's times. Little kids tend to be very early oriented. They're heavily larks rather than owls. But around the mid-teens, human beings start a pretty remarkable move toward greater and greater lateness. They naturally wake up later and go to sleep later. And this is why school start times are too early in most cases. You have the American Academy of Pediatrics saying in a policy paper a couple of years ago, please, to American school districts, please, 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 do not start school for teenagers before 8:30 in the morning. It is contraindicated by everything that we know. Early school start times have been linked by, again, this is like the Centers for Disease Control in Washington writing a report saying early school start times have been linked to teen depression, teen obesity, lower test scores, higher dropout rates, more car accidents. And it's so bad, as I said, the pediatricians of America have implored school districts, don't start school before 8:30 in the morning. And yet the average school start time in America today is 8 o'clock, which means that you have some kids in certain regions of the country who are getting on school buses at 6:30 in the morning. And that is just, you know, most 15-year-olds are not awake at 6:30 in the morning. Their eyes might be open, but they are not awake. And the other thing about this is, so, you know, adults sometimes scoff at that, saying, oh, why are you being so lazy? Come on, get out of it, just snap out of it. But it's a fundamental part of our physiology. And curing the problem is remarkably easy. We're not talking about moving school start times to 2 o'clock in the afternoon or even 11 o'clock in the morning. We're talking about starting school at 9:15 for teenagers. And the school districts that have done that have seen big improvements in test scores, big improvements in reduced dropout rates, and even some really interesting evidence on fewer car accidents. And it also ends up being a remarkably cost-effective solution. Hmm. And yet, since we don't take timing seriously, here we are with most of our teenagers going to school way too early.
In the book, you talk about had your school started school a little later, maybe you would remember more from your French class than just how to stay tired.
Just be fatigued. I remember that too.
Yeah. Exactly. But you know what? It came back to me because I had this French class in the morning and, you know, and I mean, you guys know from looking at the book where the teacher would come on and, you know, warm us up. Comment allez-vous? How are you? And every single person would say, je suis fatigué. I'm tired. And I always thought that was peculiar, but I was fatigué myself. So, you know, again, this is not a new problem, but this is one of those issues where the evidence is just overwhelming. This is not a close call.
Absolutely. And that was something I was not convinced of till I read your book, and now I'm 100% on board. Before I read your book, I'd never heard of what you just mentioned, the word chronotype. So mm-hmm. Can you tell us what are the phases throughout the day and what we should be doing during those different phases based on our chronotype?
Sure. So your chronotype is, as I said, just, you know, what's your proclivity? Or do you fall asleep early and wake up early? Do you fall asleep late and wake up late? Or are you in between? And what we know about the distribution of that is that 15% of us roughly are strong morning people. That is, we're out, we're larks. 20% of us are strong evening people, owls. And then most of us, about 2/3 of us, are kind of in between. So that's in terms of figuring out what to do when, we need to understand that first. Now, there is a pattern of the day that comes out in a whole array of different kinds of research, whether it's looking at big data analyses of Twitter, whether it's the work of Daniel Kahneman, showing a relatively predictable pattern of mood over the course of a day. And the pattern of mood goes something like this: peak, trough, recovery. Mood tends to go up, then it tends to go down in the early afternoon, and then it tends to go back up again. And these three stages, peak, trough, recovery, are pretty, I mean, there's some variation among people, and like it's not like a bell going off, and so it's uniform, so that Becky's peak and my peak and Ben's peak all start at the same exact time. But it's pretty predictable. In general, 80% of us, those of us who are larks and in the middle, we tend to go through the day in three stages: peak, trough, recovery. Peak in the morning, trough in the early afternoon, early to mid-afternoon, and then recovery later in the day. And what the research tells us is that it tells us a few and very important things. One, our cognitive abilities don't stay the same throughout the day, period. This is really important. Nobody ever told me this, okay? Our cognitive abilities don't remain constant static over the course of the day. They change, and they can change in pretty significant ways. The difference between the daily high point and the daily low point can be extreme. And then, circling in on your question, Ben, what we do, when we do stuff, really depends on what we're doing. And so there is a set of design principles based on the science that I think are eminently practical. And here's what it looks like. During the peak, that's when we should be doing our analytic work. The reason for that is that during the peak, we are most vigilant. That means that we're able to bat away distractions. And vigilance is really one of the key attributes of this peak period. We can just focus. We can knock away distractions. And so that's when we should be doing our analytic work, work that requires heads down, focus, attention. During the trough, the early to mid-afternoon for most of us, that's not good for very much. A lot of bad stuff. It really isn't. A lot of bad stuff happens. There's all kinds of increase in medical errors during that period. There's an increase in or decrease in hand washing in hospitals. It's once you factor in the number of cars on the road, it's actually two p.m. to 4 p.m. is actually a remarkably dangerous time to drive. There's a heavy disproportion of car accidents that period relative to the cars that are on the road. And so during that trough, we should be doing, if we can, trying to do some of our administrative work. Answering our routine emails, doing things that don't require a lot of brain power. And then later in the day, during the late afternoon and early evening, that's an interesting time because our mood goes back up, but we're less vigilant. And that's a pretty potent combination. When our mood is higher and we're less vigilant, that makes it a good time for brainstorming, for things that require some cognitive looseness, for creativity, for those kinds of things. All of which is to say is that we have some very clear principles about how to design our day-to-day lives. We should try to do our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during the trough, and our insight iterative work during the recovery. And it's really that simple. The problem is that we don't do that.
Listening to you as an educator, I've already got, two things kind of big strikes against me. Start times, where students come in super early and they're not ready to learn yet. And then also, right. We really have to bow before the master schedule. I mean, there's not a whole lot to control those things. So I know in your book, you give thousands of hacks and handbook tips about these things, but what can we do about this in schools to kind of combat the fact that we don't put enough emphasis on when?
It's a great question, Becky. I mean, it's a really important question. And I think you identified a pretty crucial issue in education. Now, the start time issue, remember, for elementary school kids, that doesn't matter. Start times are fine. It's really when you get to the later middle school and high school where we should be pushing back start times till, the 9 o'clock hour. Again, nothing radical. But you make another good point about the schedule. And here's the thing. When we schedule things in a school, in any kind of organization, I want to point out that I'm going to be somewhat critical of schools, but I'm critical of schools in the sense that I'm critical of organizations, and schools are a subset of organizations. When organizations of any kind schedule something, meetings, whatever, the only criterion they use in scheduling is availability. availability of people and availability of places. And this is, so it's not only a problem in schools, it's a problem in basically any kind of organization. So let's forget about schools here for a moment. Let's take, you know, any kind of business, an insurance company, a consulting firm, whatever, all right? They have to schedule a meeting. How do they schedule a meeting? They say, who's available and what rooms are available? Those are the criteria. And they don't say, is this a meeting where we need to be analytical? Is this a meeting that's purely administrative? Is this a meeting where we need to brainstorm and be iterative? We don't think about that. Who's going to be at this meeting? Are going to be people who are better in analytic work in the morning, or are going to be people who are better in later in the day? All we care about is availability. And it really matters. The totality of the research out there tells us that time of day effects alone explain about 20% of the variance in how people perform on the job. So it doesn't mean the timing is everything, but it means it's a big thing. So this is a hard problem to solve, in that you say, you have this nice turn of phrase where you say, you know, we bow before the master schedule. Well, the master schedule, I think, should bow before us. Huh. It should bow before the interests of our students. So the scheduling in schools, especially, it's tough. I totally understand that. But we think about it as a logistical issue, but it's not. And it is in part, but it's also a pedagogical issue. It's also a strategic issue. You know, we're very intentional in organizations, including schools, about what we do. You know, schools are intentional about their curriculum, what students are learning. Schools are intentional about who's going to be in the classroom. Schools are intentional about how we're teaching. But when we do stuff in schools or other organizations, always takes a back seat. And that's a mistake. That's not a mistake in touchy-feely terms, it's a mistake, because we have this mountain of evidence showing that the when has a material effect on how we perform, and has a material effect on how we learn, and needs to be factored into the decisions.
You're right. It's just a big missing piece.
It is. It's not fully missing, because, you know, we have to schedule stuff. We have to do stuff at times, but we think of it in the way, you know, in the same way that, you know, what paper towels are going to be in the boys' restroom. All right. We say, okay, someone has to make that decision, but we think of it at that level.
Yeah.
As it is a purely kind of admin, and it's not, what kind of paper towels are in the boys' restroom is not a strategic or pedagogical issue. Right. But when we have class is. And so if you go to a place like, and there's a lot of data showing this. So there's a nice study out of the University of Chicago that looked at 2 million students in the LA Unified School District. And what it found is that students who had math in the morning learned more, had higher GPAs, and did better on standardized tests than students who had math in the afternoon. And so there's a strong argument for moving subjects like math into the morning. You know, and again, we don't do that. How do we schedule math? Who's available? What room is available? Mm. And obviously that's important. Okay. You can't neglect that, but that shouldn't be driving the decision. What should be driving the decision is, how can we maximize, how can we build the best learning environment possible for our students?
You said a mountain of evidence that when is important and is crucial and vital. And I want to definitely applaud you on the whole term mountain of evidence. I don't know if I've seen sample sizes like you have, where you analyzed 500 million tweets, 14 million hand washing data sets. And
I mean, I didn't do that, but these researchers did. Yeah,
absolutely. I want to finish just identifying the problem, and then we have some questions about how we can solve it. But would you tell the story about the earnings calls and how really, I feel like that story really helped me understand that when is crucial.
Yeah, so this is a really lovely piece of research out of NYU that looked at corporate earnings calls, as you say. So the corporate earnings calls, for your listeners who might not be fully familiar with them, are calls that publicly held companies do once a quarter to, you know, led by the CEO and usually the CFO of the company, that are reporting that quarter's earnings. So let's say, you know, this quarter we had these earnings, next quarter we expect to have these kinds of earnings. And they have this call, a conference call with sometimes in the hundreds of journalists and stock analysts. And it's a big deal. And so what these researchers at NYU did is they took the transcripts of these calls, putting them into a computer program that it can measure the emotional level of the words that are used. And these researchers found that even when you control for the fundamentals of what the companies were reporting, calls in the afternoon were more negative, irritable, and combative than calls in the morning, to the point where it actually had it led to temporary stock mispricing. Wow. Now, that's weird. Yeah, exactly. That's a total wow, Ben. We can talk about why it's a wow. All right. It's a wow because the CEOs and CFOs of publicly held companies are pretty competent people in general. They're not all geniuses, believe me, but they're not bad. All right. Second, they are extremely well prepared for these things. They have talking points. They have rehearsed. They have anticipated questions. And third, they have a lot at stake in these calls because their pay is tied to what happens to the stock price. And yet even these, experienced, well-prepared, highly incentivized people are human beings. They are, as we were talking about at the top of your program, they are temporal creatures in a temporal world. And these diurnal rhythms are affecting their performance in ways they don't even realize. And so, I think it's pretty clear that, and these researchers say it in their paper, important communications with investors and things should be done earlier in the day. And I think there's probably a lesson for schools there. That is, if you're in a building, the principal's probably her important communications with teachers and whatnot should probably be done earlier in the day, with students and parents earlier in the day. At a district level, a superintendent, she should probably be communicating her important things earlier in the day.
Huh. And, we've been talking, like Ben said, a lot about the problem, which is great. And I think it's, we do not lend enough gravity to this discussion. So this is really important. But I also want to talk through a few of your solutions that you mentioned. So
sure. One
of the things you talk about a lot in the book is about breaks and the importance of breaks and how to do it well. And, how we're usually praising the guy or girl who works through lunch and doesn't take breaks.
I don't take a break. I'm an alpha,
Yeah, exactly.
Like this guy. So how do we get past that? What's the right way to take breaks?
Sure. I mean, I'm with you. I think the science shows pretty clearly that breaks are undervalued, and it's sort of like, the way we used to treat sleep. That is, people who were sleep deprived were heroes. Now we know they're fools. And so what we know about breaks for humans of all sizes and ages is that we should be taking more breaks and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. And this idea that breaks are for the weak, that we should just power through, is just flatly wrong. It's just not the way our bodies and minds work. So human beings should be taking, so as I said, we should be taking more breaks, but we should also be taking certain kinds of breaks. And there's some good research showing the sorts of breaks that are best for us. And again, there's some pretty clear design principles behind those. So if we look at something like even a short break, a 1 or 2 minute break is better than nothing. So, something is better than nothing. We know that social breaks, breaks with other people, are more restorative than breaks on our own. So, and that's true even for introverts. We know that that moving is better than stationary, and that's extremely important. I think that's reasonably well known now. We know that outside is better than inside. There's some very powerful research on the restorative effects of nature. And we know that fully detached is better than semi-detached. So we should be leaving our phones behind and we should be talking about something other than work. It's harder in a very rigidly scheduled school, but this is why we have recess. And unfortunately, I think in schools, we tend to look at recess as a concession to the kids, rather than, we look at, we're going to take a deviation from what it means to learn by having recess, when in fact, it's part of what it needs to, because breaks are part of our performance. They're not a deviation from it.
That's fascinating.
And, you guys know this already, but, you see many school districts, school buildings trying to, carve down recess, get rid of it in the name of rigor. It's a really bad idea. When in fact, there's other evidence out there in some, especially some low-income districts that are trying some experiments by giving kids a few more recesses, and they're seeing scores improve. In fact, in the Danish example that I gave you, the remedy, and again, I'm with you, Becky, in that I don't want to diagnose like a lion and prescribe like a lamb. I mean, I think it's important to offer solutions to things. The remedy in Denmark was that if you gave kids a 20 to 30 minute break to have a snack and run around before they took that afternoon test, their scores went back up.
I'd love to transition a little bit to all the work that you talk about with regards to temporal landmarks. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just speak to that a little bit and maybe let us know how schools can leverage on the science of new starts that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, so this is some interesting, well, there's a lot of research on, as you say, on what are called temporal landmarks. And those are basically that certain dates stand out in time the way that certain physical landmarks stand out in space. And what they do is these dates, like physical landmarks, they often get us to slow down and pay attention. But these temporal landmarks also trigger a really peculiar form of mental accounting, where we hit a certain date and we, in a sense, trick ourselves and open up a fresh ledger on our lives in the same way a business would open up a fresh ledger on a new quarter or a new year. And so, I mean, a great example of it, the most prominent example would be New Year's resolutions. Why do people on New Year's resolve to do things differently? Why that day? Because that's a classic fresh start date. And what I find interesting, and when people look at New Year's resolutions, it's like, oh, half of New Year's resolutions don't get kept. To me, it's like, whoa, does that mean that half of them do get kept? That's pretty amazing when you think about how hard it is to change people's behavior. And so that's the effect of temporal landmarks. So I think in schools, you know, you're better off starting something new on a Monday rather than on a Thursday, you know, on the first of a month rather than on the 13th of the month, on the first day of the semester rather than on the 11th day of the semester. And again, these, you know, choosing a fresh start date to start some kind of new program of behavior, I mean, it doesn't guarantee your success. I mean, we have, you know, it doesn't say, oh, you're set, that's all you need to do. What we're talking about here with some of these timing measures is just improving your probabilities. You know, so if you have if you're trying to get students to do something different or do something in a different way, and let's say, you know, you're a teacher in your classroom and, you know, you have a 21% chance of having students successfully do something different or do something in a different day and under ordinary circumstances. And if you choose a temporal landmark, a fresh start date, that ups your chances to 26%, say. It still means there's a 74% chance it's not going to work. All right. But I'll take that jump from 21% to 26%. I'll totally take that, because if I do that kind of thing over and over again, the numbers are going to work in my favor. And that's what we're talking about here by being more conscious of timing. We're not talking about guarantees, not even close. What we're talking about is turning the dial in our favor and probability.
And having better chances for success. I love that. And
totally.
So if you were going to design an ideal school day, taking all these things into account, or ideal school year, or, you know, when we take classes, when we do all of those things, all the stuff we've talked about so far, what would a day look like for students in your school?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a great question. And I think it's going to vary because, there are other factors besides timing there. I mean, there are questions of what. So they're big questions of what that would factor into that kind of decision. I also think it's going to depend on the students' ages as well. What I would do generally would be, you know, more breaks for students and teachers alike. Move the subjects that require fairly intense analysis, and that's basically, you know, literacy and numeracy related things, to the morning, because I think it's pretty clear that we perform better on those things in the morning. And then move the things that are equally valuable, okay, I don't want to give them a second shrift, to things like art or music or those kinds of things, to later in the day, and give kids fairly regular breaks to replenish and recharge. I also think that what we need to do is we need to pay more attention to how well it's working. I don't presume to have all the answers, anywhere close to all the answers. And I don't think that there's going to be one answer for every school or every school district. And this is why I think it's important for teachers and administrators to test, to, you know, what is it like when these students take algebra in the morning? What is it like when they take it in the afternoon? How are students feeling when performing when they have more breaks? How are they performing when they have fewer breaks? That we need to be much better observers of our own behavior and of other people's behavior. You know, I don't know if there's an ideal structure for a day, but we have to start figuring out how can we make the structure of the day better. Try that, keep what works, get rid of what doesn't, and say, okay, we've made it a little bit better. Now, how can we make it even better than that? Let's try something new. Throw out what doesn't work, keep what works. I mean, that's how any kind of system improves.
I think that's true. And 100%, you know, we are action researchers all the time. We look at, you know, what's working in our practice, but we very often only look at the what and the how. I don't know that I've ever taken the when into account when I'm looking at my students' test scores, or, you know, I'm looking at the success of a professional development that I've run. So even just being intentional about including that in part of our analysis can be huge.
Exactly. I mean, that's a great first step. Is, you know, we include that as another variable when you're when you are evaluating things. You know, I think it's pretty, you know, it's pretty clear in at least the way I'm looking at, the way I look at the research, that for these things that for these sorts of tasks that we, you know, things. I mean, again, you know, I'm not. I really want to be clear that I'm not saying math is the most important subject that you can take, and therefore you should take it first. That's not my argument. My argument is that math requires, mathematical thinking requires a certain kind of focus that other disciplines necessarily do not. And therefore, we tend to be more focused and vigilant at different times of the day.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes perfect sense. I don't think you're downplaying art and music at all. It's just what when our brain is better at adapting to those different disciplines.
You talked about all of these changes definitely just increase the chance of something being successful. And another little hack you have in your book that increases the chance of something being successful that I thought applied perfectly to our schools is the idea of a pre-mortem. Can you tell us what that idea is and how that might work for a teacher or principal?
Yeah, that's an idea from a psychologist named Gary Klein. It's a brilliant idea. It's something that I use a lot, and it works like this. So we all know what a postmortem is. Postmortem is when you person has died and you say, okay, what were the causes of death? All right, so after death, you figure out what the causes were. Premortem is sort of a form of mental time travel. And so let's say you're starting a project and you say, you know, you have a semester long project you have to do as a teacher, or you're, you know, running a new professional development offering or whatever you're doing. What you can do is you can project out to the end of that and say, suppose it's 5 months from now and this project, this program is a total abject failure. What went wrong? And start listing all the things that went wrong. Oh, we didn't bring people in to co-create the material. We didn't take the time of day and scheduling it carefully enough. We didn't give people the materials in advance, far enough in advance. Start thinking about all the things that you imagine the project went completely off the rails. What went wrong? And you start listing the things that went wrong. And then that gives you things that you can do better. So if we know that, oh, we screwed up because we didn't get the materials to people in far enough in advance and they didn't have time to read it, then you say, oh, great. So what we're going to do, we're going to make sure we get the materials to people far enough in advance. And so it allows you to make mistakes in your head and then come up with the solutions before you make mistakes in real life and have to wait till the next project to come up with the solutions.
And that would be something I start every class with, every new...
Maybe class in the sense like every course.
Exactly, At the start of every school year, I would have my student be like, hey, the AP test is in 9 months. You get a 1 on the test. What do you think you did wrong that made you fail that AP test?
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, and I love the idea. And I was actually being a little top down in my prescription here because I like your suggestion better because you're bringing the students into doing the postmortem, premortem. You're not actually having it done only by the teacher. I think that kind of technique for students would be brilliant. I think students would love to know that.
Yeah.
Would love to. And I think they're very good muscles. They're very good reasoning and planning muscles to build. Now, I think it's especially true for boys, you know, because boys generally behind girls in that kind of executive and planning function. And this might be a good tool for them.
Yeah, we're kind of better in every way. What about when would that happen then? Because I see both the analytical side to that and then also the creative side to that. So would that be like a recovery activity, or would that be more of a peak activity?
I don't know. I mean, I would try it both ways, but my hunch is that it's probably more of an analytic activity.
Interesting.
But I don't know. I would try it both ways.
Yeah, totally. Okay.
You know, and here's the thing. It's like we can't get everything at exactly the right time. So,
right.
You know, what I would do is that if you end up doing it, you know, if it ends up being later in the day and it turns out to be an analytic activity, give everybody a break beforehand, you know, have it go out and, you know, take a 10-minute walk outside with everybody and then come in and do it. So if you have doesn't work in every school building. I understand that because there's so, you know, there's so many, it's very, you know, the amount of autonomy that teachers and students have is so incredibly constricted. But, you know, if it's possible, you know, let's say you have a 45-minute class period to do a premortem and it's later in the day, take the first 10 minutes and take everybody on a walk outside for 5 minutes, you know?
That's gorgeous. So this is going to sound like interview whiplash, but I want to make the most of our time with you. What you talk a little bit in the book about synchronizing in time with other people and what that does for our brain. Can you talk a little bit about that and what can educational leaders learn from that science and trying to get everybody on the same page?
There's some really interesting research on how groups synchronize and in time. So things like certain supply chains and lunch deliverers and choral groups and rowers. Group synchronization abides by a certain set of rules that if you want everybody to be, it's not only that you want everybody, this is more than getting everybody on the same page, you want everybody kind of working in synchrony with each other. And you want that sometimes, you don't want that for every activity, but I think there's another great opportunity for schools here too in fostering that kind of thing, because what we know about synchronous activity is that it makes us feel good. There's no question about it. It boosts our mood. It boosts our well-being. But it also boosts our many kinds of what are called pro-social actions. And so there's some just remarkable research. So let's take choral singing. Choral singing is so good for you. It's shocking. I mean, it's shocking how good singing a chorus is for you. It improves your mood. It's prophylactic against depression. It improves your immune response. It makes you more likely to do a good deed afterwards. It raises your pain threshold. I mean, on every dimension of life, physiological, psychological, social, it is a plus. It's as close to physical exercise and its overall awesomeness. And there's another side of it that's so interesting is that when we're engaged in synchronous activity afterwards, we're more likely to do good. And this is really interesting. Some great research with kids. So kids who play, you take two groups of kids. There's some good research out of Oxford on this. You take two groups of kids. One plays a fun game. It's a totally fun game. The other plays a totally fun game that happens to be synchronous. So like a clap and tap game where everybody claps and taps at the same time. So they do this for, you know, play a game, a totally fun game for 30 minutes that's asynchronous. And the other group plays a 30-minute game that's totally fun but is synchronous. And the kids who play the synchronous game afterwards are more likely to cooperate, more likely to help the teacher, more open to playing with kids who don't look like them. It's just amazing. You see the same thing even on swinging on swing sets. It was just mind-boggling. So that when you have kids who swing, two kids swinging asynchronously and two kids swinging synchronously, the kids singing synchronously, again, show the same kind of pattern immediately afterwards. More open-minded, more generous, more pro-social. So all of this tells us that there is something profound and deeply human about synchronizing with other people, that it's part of what it is to be human in so many ways. And school offers a great opportunity to start building that in our students.
I often wonder if some of my own brilliance is the fact that I was in college choir, and I'm sure you pick up on some of that.
Yeah, totally.
But I 100% agree with all that. Yeah. Amazing. So many of our teachers, so many of our principals and leaders refer to all of your work with regards to student motivation. And so I feel like I would love to ask this as one of our last questions. You speak a lot to autonomy, mastery, and purpose when you talk about motivation for students. And I was wondering if you could just tell us, do you see any great examples of schools that have really taken the recommendations you've given and kind of the results you've seen because of it?
Well, I mean, I don't know if they've taken the stuff that I've written about, but there are some schools that are, you know, I actually think that there are hidden heroes all over the U.S. school system. The U.S. school system, you know, seems to be pelted with bad news, bad news, bad news, bad news, bad news, when in fact, there's some really astonishing great things going on out there. Teachers doing really remarkable things. So when it comes to autonomy, you have a whole movement now in education for what's called a genius hour, where kids can take an hour a week to work on whatever they want and show their project to their fellow students. So more of these self-directed projects, which are, you know, it's clear that they are a very powerful way for students to learn subject matter, but they also end up building, I hate this word, but they end up building non-cognitive skills in persistence and in planning and in all those kinds of things that we need to be fully functioning human beings, workers, and citizens. You see in the realm of mastery, what I think is, again, a small thing, but in elementary schools and in high schools, these student-led conferences. So that, I mean, it's just kind of ridiculous that you have a parent-teacher conference about a student, you know, regularly scheduled parent-teacher conference where the parents go in to talk to the teacher, and the most important person in the conversation isn't even there. And so these student-led conferences, I think, are a great example of how students achieve their own mastery, how students, you know, can direct their own learning. And then, you know, on purpose, there are just trying to break down some of the boundaries between the school and the real world. So students doing science where they're taking, you know, measurements out in the real world or trying to solve problems in the school or in their local community. And it's in some ways lazy to be downbeat and pessimistic about American education. That's the easy way to do it. But I think if you work harder and look harder, there are just, as I said before, hidden heroes and pockets of excellence out there that are truly remarkable. The challenge is, how do we scale those things? But leaving that challenge of scale aside, there's a lot of good stuff going on. And I think that there's some, you know, heroic teachers out there who are doing extraordinary things.
100%. I so appreciate you saying that too, because I think that's absolutely the truth. It's a lot easier to sit back and look for all the negatives. It's harder work to really celebrate what's actually happening. And there are some phenomenal things happening in schools.
Absolutely.
Okay, so last question, because I know we're running short on your time. You know, we're an education podcast. Even though the efficacy of homework can be debated, can you give our listeners one or two pieces of homework to improve on some of the things that we discussed?
You have to do the homework if Daniel Pink gives it to
you.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. What I would do is, there's a worksheet in the book to do this, is, as I said before, I think we need to be better observers of our own behavior. And so what I like to do is just take a week and more systematically look at how you're feeling, how you're doing at different times of day. We have an easy worksheet to do that. I mean, you don't have to use that, but there are ways to do that. Just, you know, just be better observers. Like, are you better in the morning? Are you better in the afternoon? How are you feeling at 2? How are you feeling at 9? How are you feeling at 4? And just get a sense that, you know, I can tell you and show you the evidence that our cognitive abilities aren't the same throughout the day. But if you actually see that and observe that in your own behavior and own life, it's going to stick more powerfully. So that's one thing that I would do.
Absolutely.
The other thing would be, I'll give you another. I write in the book about beginnings, middles, and ends. I would pay very careful attention to endings. And there's some teachers I write about in the book who do some really extraordinary things on endings, where at the end of the semester or the end of a year, there's one high school teacher in Illinois who has his seniors write letters to themselves that he mails to them 5 years later, which is pretty remarkable. There are other teachers who bring in and have a massive pancake breakfast on the final day of school. There's a college teacher, I love this one, the college teacher who on the final day takes her students out and they make to a bar, not something you want to do for under 21, but take students out to a bar and they make toast to each other and talk about what they learned. But you can imagine that in like a second or third grade classroom.
Yeah.
Where students make toasts to each other about what they like about the other person or what they learned during the year from that other person. That's just gorgeous. And so endings have a big, big effect on our behavior, on our well-being. And there's some really astonishing teachers out there who are doing extraordinary things on endings.
Well, and a spoiler alert, or maybe a teaser, at the end of your chapter on endings, you get a special little signature thing from Daniel Pink. So you might want to read that carefully.
You might read carefully.
Totally. Well, let's end on this. Where can our listeners go to learn more from and with you?
The best place to go is my website, which is www.danpink.com. You can also go to points to danielpink.com. And that has information about the books and an email newsletter and all kinds of groovy stuff.
All right, let's close up shop. Becky, what did we learn?
Well, peak trough recovery. I did an analysis of my chronotype, and I tried to reorient my day so that I do my administrative work during my trough, like email, creative work during my recovery, and analytic work during my peak. I've been trying to change when I schedule meetings, but that's a little bit of a heavier lift because, you know, we're all kind of subject to the tyranny of the schedule. But I've also tried to take his advice about detached outside breaks. So when I have 10 minutes free, rather than putzing around on Twitter or Pinterest, I'm trying to get myself outside and really decompress. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I've also tried scheduling my day based on what is the best thing I could be doing at that time. It's been awesome. The other thing that really challenged me that I learned from Daniel is the idea of temporal landmarks. And I know that I use those with fitness and other areas of my life. And I'm really challenged to think of how can I use those next year with teachers. There are tons of burnout points in the year with teachers. And I think really helping them focus on some temporal landmarks could maybe bump my chances of success from 21 to 26, and I think that's worth it. Even just right now, we're at the end of the year, teachers are feeling the stress, and I noticed on Twitter this new thing started up called hashtag May Matters and hashtag Teach to the Last Bell, and just the idea of really just focusing on May and making May great. And so I think temporal landmarks are a great way to encourage teachers. So I'm looking forward to using those. I also just want to encourage listeners to read WIN. There are just tons of nuggets. We got through a lot of them. One of the ones we didn't talk about in the interview today, but I want to encourage our listeners to try over summer break, perhaps, is this beautiful thing called a Nappuccino. And I had the opportunity of taking a Nappuccino this weekend, and it blew my mind. It was awesome. So basically, caffeine takes 30 minutes to hit your bloodstream. So if you pound a coffee and then go take a 25-minute nap, which science shows is the best length of a nap, you wake up and have the benefits of a nap, and as you're waking up, the caffeine's hitting your bloodstream. You're wired and ready to rock. So Nappuccino is another one of my big takeaways.
I thought when I was in med school and I had to study all afternoon, I would take Nappuccinos around like 1 o'clock. I didn't know that's what they were called or that it was, you know, really working, but it helped so much, and I never really thought about why. So that's fun. So homework for today. Dan has a super quick survey on his website where you can identify your chronotype and start to tweak your daily schedule accordingly. But really, with the classroom in mind, we think it would be worth your while to think through how you plan the when of your instruction, or even how a student's individual work might be affected by the when of their own daily activities. We heard Glenn Whitman last week talk about the importance of starting school later for adolescents, and Daniel Pink reiterated that in this interview. So how can we make minor shifts in our morning or afternoon instruction to capitalize on what type of work will be most effective for the majority of our learners? And if most people are peak, trough, recovery, third birds, what does that tell us too about the homework that we're assigning, if any?
For sure. And since this is a landmark, an ending to the school year, we're hoping that as you listen to this, you're already thinking, how can you make your ending of the school year powerful for your students? Daniel gave some great examples in our podcast about ways teachers have ended class in a really powerful way. We hope you are thinking of creative ways you can end class. How can you leave your students with some conundrums or things to ponder over the school year and or over their summer break and cognitively struggle over their summer? And then maybe thinking about starts as well. How can you start next year in a powerful new way?
So in summary, we need to start thinking through how we can work with our brains and bodies instead of simply according to our own ideal schedules. And with that, we will wish you a great generic time of day. Thanks for listening.